Okay, welcome back to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. I'm your host, Paul Randack. As I said a couple weeks ago, I was going to be taking some time off this summer to work on a Alta resort or town podcast with my father-in-law. And that is in the works at this point. But we're going to be doing a couple of the Just Another Bozo on the Bus podcast over the next week or so. And today I am excited and honored. I would say I usually introduce my guests as friends and colleagues and associates, but today my guest is John Randack, who is my son.
Present.
And I'm really honored and happy to have him here. Now he came down to visit for a couple days, and he's got a story that I think will be helpful to a number of people and share, and people will relate to. And looking forward to the next hour when we sit and talk. And we won't hopefully talk too much about family shit, but it may come out from time to time. So
unavoidable at times.
Unavoidable at times. But anyway, Johnny, hi. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really honored you asked me, so thank you.
So I don't know where you want to begin with your story that you'd like to tell and what makes you just another bozo on the bus. where would you like to start? What are the places that you want to discuss first?
That's a great question. You know, in my recent life, I think about inflection points. I try to think back on like what the big inflection points were for me in my life. And I can do my best to flag a couple of those, and then maybe I'll dive into the one that I feel like I can talk about in the most interesting way. You know, I my early childhood, some of the inflection points were probably, you know, divorce and shuffling around. Those feel like emotional touch points and inflection points. Mm-hmm. There was another emotional inflection point when I got expelled from the, as you know all of this, of course.
Well, being your father, I do remember getting divorced.
Yes. What listeners might not know about me is that I got expelled from the private school that I went to when I was 12 or 13 years old. Or no, yeah, after ninth grade. So no, I would have been 15, maybe.
I think around 15.
Yeah. And then I got dropped into public school, having been at a private school my entire life, so I did not know anyone. That was a very, I consider that an inflection point because it definitely altered the trajectory of who I was going to be socially, and I had to adapt and develop social skills that I have to imagine I wouldn't have adapted otherwise, and the kind of people I met were different, the quantity of people I met was very different, and that's when I started playing music, really. I know I'd played a little bit of music before that, but that's when I started playing music in bands, and that was pretty exciting. I'll flag a pretty difficult breakup in my early 20s, which sort of precipitated me starting to drink very alcoholically and sort of take a lot of drugs. And there's a lot of travel in my 20s. And then I would say, you know, the biggest inflection point of the past decade of my life has been when I got sober from drugs and alcohol, which will be 7 years ago in July.
Woohoo!
July 18th of 2019. God willing, I will have 7 years of continuous sobriety. And, you know, that is a really easy, not just because it's of its recency, but also because you put so much... You have an inflection point like that, and then it's something you work at all the time and think about all the time. And the contrast between the before and the after is a pretty easy thing to talk about. All of those other things, it was really clear. I didn't know they were big inflection points at the time, you know? Like, they felt like big life events at the time, but it's really easy for me to talk about the ways in which, you know, life is different after you get sober. And,
yeah.
And how working on yourself changes, yeah, or working on yourself at all.
Well, I remember that moment or that time, one, because you weren't here in this country.
Correct.
And the phone call you made to me from Paris, mm-hmm, was a very powerful phone call for me too. And I remember we talked for, I don't know, 40 minutes or something like that. And I could tell that there was something had happened. I mean, I could tell that there was a change.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember that phone call, but I don't remember. it has nothing to do with you and everything to do with that first month is a total blur in my mind.
Yeah.
But something I do remember recording a video of myself, you know, in one of the last days before I finally got clean. And
do you still have that video?
No, I actually sold my computer. I went looking for it recently I sold my computer to a friend in Paris, and I think I forgot to download that. And I would be so fascinated to see that now. But it was sort of like a video journal entry of why I was going to stop and where I was at and what I was feeling. It was my bottom, you know, it was the incomprehensible demoralization on video, which is why I would love to see it now, because you know, it's 6.5 years later.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of like see how far that string has come.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah. I would just love to look into my eyes and see that pain that I was in, because I was suffering immeasurably. Mm-hmm. And you probably heard that on that call, I imagine. And what was your impression talking to me?
Well, that's a really good question, too. I mean, I heard something. I mean, your voice sounded so different because you had made this decision. And I could tell in your voice that it was true,
right,
just by the way you talked about it and how you felt about it. And there was an underlying vulnerability in your voice. And there wasn't a lot of space between your voice and the emotion. It was there a very thin veil, if there was one at all. And that's one thing that stood out. And the reasoning and the thoughts that you had behind this is that, but I remember one of the things you said is, I go, I can't imagine being in Paris or in France, you know, in Europe for a year and, you know, and not being present and not being aware of the moment and not living each day new. Mm. And I remember that so much that stood out to me. And I remember sort of, you know, I got a little choked up at that point too, because I know what that feeling's like when I want to have a different experience of my life and reality and how they fit together.
I definitely remember that feeling. I remember feeling like I was just throwing days away, and I threw days away for over a decade and didn't really have too big of a problem with it, because I was, you know, in my hometown or somewhere where I was really comfortable with, or somewhere where maybe the expectation wasn't that I was supposed to be having this incredible time. And I wonder if, you know, going to Paris and waking up in that city every day and then still feeling like these were throwaway days living in Paris, just that was really hard for me to sit with, that I was squandering this opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think that accelerated that for me a lot. And the loneliness was just because I didn't speak the language well yet, didn't know anyone there. It just really fast-tracked me down to the bottom, you know.
Well, that's a really interesting thought. So choosing to get sober there and then, and then engage into, you know, a 12-step program.
Yeah, English-speaking. A lot of people don't know this. There's a big English-speaking recovery contingent in Paris, about 40 meetings a week, multiple every day in English.
Yeah. Which is amazing, you know, and wonderful. Amazing and wonderful at the same time.
Yeah.
So that, I wonder if that also created an impetus to be able to connect locally to the community. I mean, I don't want to make an assumption, but I think about this was, you know, how many of the people there in those meetings were American and from other countries, you know, throughout Europe too. I mean, I can only imagine it's being somewhat of a menagerie of different dwellers.
Yeah, I'll speak to that second thing and then go back to the first. Yes, it is a total potpourri of different nationalities. I would say half the people, if not more, were English second language. People from the UK, people from South Africa, people from South America, just people from all over. A lot of Irish people, which was great. We had a lot of like very eccentric Irish men in the meetings for whatever reason. And that was as fun as anything else, was getting to, I mean, there is a cast of characters in any meeting, if you go to the US, just based on the diversity of personality types and backgrounds and stories. But once you start adding nationalities as like another dimension of the way that people are different, it just gets even more fun. But to the first thing you said about, did it become, and I'm just going to paraphrase, did it become a place where I could plug in socially? Mm-hmm. Yes, unequivocally. I think that that is the reason when people ask me why do I feel like it's stuck this time for me, I say two things. One, I felt like I was ready and that I had gotten sober once and then gone back out and then had gotten sober again. And I think I needed that first time. And so when I got sober the second time, I was a little bit more convinced that it was for real that time, because mm-hmm. I had thought like I could go back out and drink like a gentleman, as they say, the first time. So I had that knowledge. And then I also say that I really found for the first time a fellowship that I had never found when I tried to get sober in Portland. I found a group of people that really brought me in. And I'm sure later on in the conversation, we'll talk about connection and how important that is to people who are recovering. And you know as much about that as anyone. But I did. I felt like I was suddenly in a nest. I felt like I was around people who liked me. I was around people who supported me. I felt like I was a part of a family, a tribe, all of those words you use when you talk mm-hmm. about connection. I just felt like I had a tribe suddenly.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to leave. And as you know, I was supposed to leave after 3 months and I stayed for a full year. I skipped my flight and didn't come home until weeks before Patrick, my brother, my older brother, got married, and probably would have stayed years had Patrick not. I was the best man in Patrick's wedding.
Which we're all glad you showed up for. And I'm sure you are too. Yes. I mean, that was really quite an occasion.
I mean, I feel like I can always really confidently speak to the connection piece of, or how important the connection piece is, because I really do feel like that is what, without that, had it just been academic, you know, had it just been the theory behind recovery and the exercises and all that kind of stuff, I don't know if it would have stuck for me. But something about finally feeling like I had a tribe and a group of people who I belonged with and they accepted me and wanted me there, was very powerful for me.
That's a really beautiful, you know, way to express what that was like. And yes, connection is so vital. And not just paraphrasing, Johann Hari's philosophy and ideas behind this, that the opposite of addiction is connection. But the truth being that I think as much as the word is connection, it's belonging. Mm-hmm. Which is being part of something. And I know connection in a way emphasizes that, but I do like the idea or the notion of belonging with something or that's more, because connection, it's like there's an engagement with belonging and feeling accepted, that I think that there's that maybe speaks to a level of vulnerability that goes above the surface and maybe more into the depths of some kind of shared. I know I'm waxing a little philosophical here, but the depths of shared human experience. And I think that's the power of the fellowship, too.
Yeah, I think I'm tracking with you. I do. It almost sounds as if you're trying to say there's a difference between connection and belonging, and if I were to, you know, armchair wax poetic here, it would be that I think you can connect with like a lot of things. I think you can connect with like an animal, or I connect with my dog, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
We connect often. She connects with me, I connect with her, but I don't feel that same sense of belonging with her. I felt belonging in AA, and the difference, if I had to just take a stab at it, is that I felt like these people who had how can I say this? My dog, I feed my dog. My dog cares about me and loves me because I've created like a stable home environment, consistency. There's food. All of her needs are getting met. And so I think this is like, as a biological process, she accepts of me and likes me. These are people with wants, needs, ideas, opinions. They can like people. They cannot like people. And these people took me in. And so that's, I guess, how I would describe belonging. You know, I felt like they judged me in a good way and accepted me. I felt acceptance, you know, in this group of people. And I think when you're in early recovery, you so strongly don't accept of yourself, you know, that's the low self-esteem piece. I just did not accept who I was or where I was at, or, you know, I thought that I was overall sort of like negative equation, you know, when you added up all my strengths and weaknesses, I felt like I was in the negative. And so I couldn't accept myself. So to have a group of people actively working to accept me, that felt like belonging to me.
And that they were motivated to do so. I mean, that was actually part of their purpose, was also seeking out connection.
Right.
that which then maybe that, you know, we look at what's the difference between connection and belonging. And I wasn't meaning when I look back to necessarily differentiate too much from them, but this idea of belonging is, I think, really maybe ties in or is geared to this idea of acceptance. You know, this is, it's okay to be here. I'm home in a way, you know, and maybe that's that tribe piece as well.
That's exactly how I felt. And I'll just very quickly close the loop on that to say, you and I were speaking, you know, while I've been here about, you know, that our lives can become kind of atomized or bifurcated or what was the word you used? Pixelated? No, I want to, you used a great word.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember either. Digitized or no?
Yeah. I can't. But the point is, you know, my life is a lot more like that here than it was there, where I have like different pockets of friends and different, like I've got my work friends. And I think most people will identify with that. They've got this variety of people that they're connecting with, and sometimes they don't overlap. This was my whole world for that year. I didn't really have different groups of friends. I mean, this was it. So in terms of like belonging and connection piece, I mean, this was about as pure as it got, you know. Well, I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying I didn't during that period feel completely like I was floating from group to group, creating a sort of like Frankenstein social life, you know, as I sometimes feel like I do today. you know, it was all just this one. I went to this one place for the source of that. And I'm really glad that was there.
Yeah, what a magical time.
Yeah, no, I feel really lucky to have. There are so many reasons to have gratitude for that, to be able to have had the money to do that, the time to do that. You know, it really changed the trajectory of my life. And so, just going back to inflection points, yeah, that's as big as any of the rest of them. And I was an adult when it happened, so I think I can speak more cogently about it because I was rather present.
Yeah.
You know, it's harder for me to reflect back on some of those ways I was feeling as a child for some of those other events. But I really vividly remember how I felt before and after that event.
Yeah. You know. Well, and I remember that too. I remember right before you left too. And I was up, I mean, I was with you at your graduation. I can't remember how long you left after that, after the graduation when you went to.
Oh, very soon.
It was pretty quick. Yeah.
Like a month or so.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so where do you want to jump to hit now?
As far as gosh, I yeah, I'm happy to discuss
if you want to talk about the divorce.
which one?
Yes, I have had multiple divorces.
Well, I can't. You know, I can't really speak about. So, you and my mom got divorced, obviously, when I was about 5, I think. And I was about 13, I think, when you and Catherine got divorced. And don't really have many memories of you and Mary, you and when I was that young. And yeah, so I can't speak to that one very much. And with Catherine, do you have any specific questions about it?
No.
What do I remember?
No. It was, well, and that's when, you know, I went through, right before I divorced Catherine was when I had my dove into the pool of sobriety and 12-step, actually. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, a dramatic change for me as well. And I remember that time leading up to it, even though, you know, I know this is not my time to tell my story. I've done that a few times now. But, you know, that was a pretty dark time in my life for periods. And, you know, I can only imagine what it was like for you. I mean, you and I have talked about it previously at different times. And my thoughts always go back to, you know, the bubble that I was living in. And I think about that, especially as being a father, that, you know, it sometimes becomes insulated. Maybe, and not always insulated in a healthy way, because it leads to certain kinds of isolation. And I definitely was experiencing that those few months leading up to the point that I decided to make the choice to pursue sobriety. And if I look at the events that led up to it, I realized that, you know, and as you know, that around addiction, it's a very selfish place to be in. And isolation's sort of a byproduct of that, mm-hmm. that selfishness. I expect that, you know, in that case, I think more of this with the second marriage with Catherine, that probably had a bigger impact on you, partially to what I was going through, but also, you know, how things ended up. As far as an inflection point, I'm just curious what stands out to you.
I think it's easier to speak about, it's like my childhood in aggregate rather than like that actual divorce, mm-hmm. because I think the divorce itself, by the time it happened, I felt pretty numb to the experience. It was kind of like expected in a way. Mm-hmm. So when you guys separated, it wasn't like an acute kind of pain. It was sort of, we all knew this was going to happen or assumed this was going to happen. And I think I had more logistical concerns than emotional ones at the time,
yeah.
you know, wondering where we were going to live and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I guess I mentioned that as an inflection point, and yet I can't really, yeah, speak about what that, I could speak about what that process was like, but it's also pretty hazy for me. I think if I were going to speak about, you know, that time of my life in aggregate, I think, you know, part of what I, one thing I really find that I do as an adult is I am really uncomfortable unless I can, I feel like I have very secure surroundings, and I think that that was something that may or may not have come from that. But I think there was an unpredictability to that. That was what I was left feeling, was
things being in flux a little bit, not knowing.
Yeah, and just wondering, like, where, okay, so some of these walls are coming down, and where are the new walls going to come from? What are those going to look like? What are the boundaries going to be? What are the, you know, what's the discipline going to be? What are the rules going to be? Who is going to be setting those rules? Look, I mean, I think probably looking for some sort of stability, continuity, predictability. Mm-hmm. And I definitely pulled that into my adult life. I definitely find myself being more uncomfortable than some of my other friends with unpredictability and really wanting to know sort of where the boundaries are around me so I can kind of settle, I guess, a lot of the time. So, but yeah, I think that was the big emotional takeaway, I think, from that experience, was at that point, I think we were... And again, you know, self-reporting this, I feel like it's only like, you know, it's approximate data, you know, because I that feels like a very blurry time in my life, you know, that period.
Well, me too. I mean, that was, you know, a big change for me as well. So I can only imagine what it was like being in your shoes. I definitely realized a certain level of selfishness on my part, because the whole idea in recovery, especially early recovery, is how much you're supposed to focus on yourself. Yeah. And I look back at that and think, you know, that, and I still agree. I mean, I still agree with that. Being as a therapist and a counselor, I know that there are practical and rational reasons why to do that. But this other part that it's always trying to find this interesting balance is how to do that within a family system when there are responsibilities.
Right.
And I can only imagine what that was like, again, as you just described it, this feeling of flux around you, not knowing who was going to make the rules and have, you know, where were you going to be and those kinds of things. So when you say you took that into your adult life, and I'm assuming you meet into relationships too, probably. So,
yeah, any kind of environment. I mean, I'm someone who, you know, there's always that person who feels uncomfortable unless their back is to the wall in a restaurant and stuff like that. I think that's one way that can kind of show up, you know, is you literally, that's a literal representation of wanting to see the boundaries, the periphery of the building. You
yes.
know, I want to know where the walls are. I want to know who the people coming in and out are. I want, you know, that allows my brain to rest
yes.
when I feel like I can survey the scene.
Yeah.
So I do that both, you know, in the geographical and physical world, and I probably do that in the emotional world as well. I like to feel like I sort of have some sort of control around all the variables, which is, of course, silly, because like that kind of control is somewhat of an illusion. But I do my best to try to
yeah.
you know. And that's going to be one of my sort of fun little projects in my adult life, is to sort of loosen that a bit, because I do think that that can limit you in ways, you know, if you sometimes, I guess the way I would put it is if you cling too tightly to needing control over people, places, or things, you know, you don't allow for a lot of life to pass through that. You know what I mean? A lot of
just exactly.
This free flow of like the breeze, the gentle breeze of life that kind of comes in and out, you know? And I've experienced that.
You know? Well, I would guess, you know, from my experience too, is that it's hard to live in the moment that way too. And in any type of, you know, dealing with any type of personal growth or mental health or spiritual path in life, there seems to be a simple doctrine on some level, or at least some kind of basic mantra, that it's best to be in the moment. It's best to live in the moment. Right. And I look back, you know, throughout my life, and if I go back through my childhood, the same kind of thing can happen, is that I'm still carrying some of these, you know, entrails all the way through, you know, up until, you know, from 6 to 60, so to speak, you know.
Right.
It happens. It happens.
So. Yeah, I think it stops you from being in the moment. I do think it hinders you. And the one way that I've learned to treat it is really just... So, you know, having the sort of safe space that you're looking to sort of observe, or, you know, just in yourself, you know, becoming the safe space, becoming in your mind.
I like that. I like that. Becoming the safe space.
Yeah. I think that's all one who, you know, we don't need to get into attachment theory or anything like that, because I know that that's sort of can be controversial as a sort of like modality of thought. But I do think that for people who don't consider themselves secure, which I don't myself, you know, that that is one thing I can do to try to become more secure, is to feel secure in myself, and to feel like I am a person of integrity who holds to my values, and that I can just feel safe, you know. There are a variety of ways you can do that, but I think taking care of yourself is one of them. It's just knowing that you can rely on yourself to be there for yourself, you know.
Oh, we can't go into attachment theory, so I can't say that you inherited some of my disorganized avoidant attachment that I learned as a childhood.
I think that would be very poignant.
Yes.
No, we can definitely
we don't need to, but it's such a great conversation. I mean, I have it so often with, you know, other people to sit here and talk about my own is fascinating at the same time, because of course that may happen to you, right? That you may pick up on that, because that's what I learned. The idea of creating secure attachment, though, you know, I guess the beauty of that, that I see, is that you can learn that. It can be learned.
Don't
have to be, you know, stuck in, or at least I can say for myself, I didn't have to be stuck in a place where I was avoidant all the time.
Right.
I still see it that come up,
right.
You know, being married for now 21 years, I think, or maybe a little bit more. I should probably know that, right? That I can still see when avoidant mechanisms kind of click in.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, my therapist calls it earned secure. Which I think find a very pleasant term.
I like that.
Yeah. And she, my current therapist in Portland, was my couples counselor with my ex. And this was, you know, we've been broken up for almost 3 years. But in our second session, couples therapy session, she looked at me after I had, you know, been talking for a minute, as I am wont to do. And she just said, "Have you ever heard of attachment theory?" And I said, "No." And she's like, "So you probably don't know, like, what avoidant attachment means." And I said, "No, I mean, I can kind of glean what it might mean just from hearing you say that." She's like, "I think that you are an avoidant attachment style." And she's like, "I'd really love to explore that here, if that's something you'd be open to." And then when me and my ex broke up, as maybe I was avoiding a deeper level of intimacy with her, I asked her, you know, my ex, and I just said, "Would you be comfortable with me seeing our therapist, just, you know, private one-on-one?" And she gave me her blessing, and we have been doing attachment work basically ever since then. It's a different, completely different kind of therapy than I've ever done in my life. But yeah, that's something we work on a lot and talk about a lot, is strategies for creating earned secure.
It's beautiful.
Yeah,
that's beautiful. Well, I mean, I'm curious, that you went to her to see her as a couple.
Yeah, and as then a boyfriend.
At
the time, I was seeing her as a boyfriend of a partner. That was my role in
a boyfriend of a partner. Right, I love it. Okay.
Now I'm just a human. Yeah.
and then you saw her, then you continued on as an individual.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when she started describing attachment theory to me, mm-hmm. I felt like she was describing like the red on the inside of a bullseye. You know what yeah. I mean? Like the hue of the red. I was just like, this is me. Yeah. This is everything you're saying is, you know. And I'd never heard someone talk about it before, mm-hmm. you know, and whether or not, you know, the three attachment style types is like a little reductive or too simple, that's completely possible. I've heard people kind of lobby that criticism of it, but I do think it's an interesting lens to look at people through the anxious, avoidant, and secure model. You know, yeah. I'm sure you could fill in little granularities or there's probably sure. overlap and all yeah. that kind of stuff, but I really resonate as an avoidant,
yeah.
you know, and when I read about what that means, it really lands for me.
So Are you surprised to hear that I'm
not
also okay? I mean, it would make sense, right?
Absolutely,
that it would be yeah. something that I would continue to be working on as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like father, like son, and so when you, I'm curious. You know, you said the one of the other markers that you were discussing was this. You know, this relationship that you were in for over a year.
Yeah, year and a half almost.
No, I was thinking when I was going backwards a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So, the one of the markers that you were describing was this long-term relationship that you had that kind of set a tone for you know, what you took into adulthood. And I wonder if you, looking back, that you see that same kind of understanding of, you know, I'm pretty sure you did, because like myself, I would go back and look at all my relationships through that lens of my avoidant attachment and actually look, you know, even though it was uncomfortable to do, look at the behavior I had in those relationships where I projected that avoidance.
Yeah, it's a really great question. I get really hesitant to talk about the, you know, dissolve of that relationship, not because it's something I'm uncomfortable talking about, but because it's all that I would talk about with my friends for about a decade.
Oh, well, after. Yeah. We don't need to go into any details
right.
today, no.
But yeah. One thing I haven't talked a lot about is, like how my, you know, emotional eccentricities, you might call them. Uh-huh. I mean, this is like marketing, by the way. This is like, that's what I do for a living these days. I do marketing. So I find, try to find positive ways.
We'll talk about that yeah. before we end today.
But it is interesting now with some of the new lenses that I've picked up through the years, and many of which I've picked up in recovery, to look at that breakup, to look at that time in my life and sort of imagine sort of what was playing out then and all of the ways that, like, sort of my low self-esteem and you know, a lot of needs that I, you know, tried to meet in that relationship that I wasn't able to meet, just to be fully transparent, I mean, I started And this is also a big part of my story, and something I guess to know about me is that, you know, I got into recovery going to AA meetings, but that's really not the main focus of my recovery anymore. The main focus of my recovery is much more around my, you know, secondary addictions, what they call process addictions, around women and food now, you know. And so in going to SLAA meetings, which I do quite often now, I mean, that's where I've picked up some of the tools to sort of really see what played out in that relationship. And
I think for our listeners, I'll explain SLA is sex and love, right?
Yeah, addiction. Sex and love addicts. Yeah, and just to give you a really high level overview of what people who consider themselves love addicts are working to solve for, I mean, they really just find that, you know, in recovery, in 12-step, we say we have something called a God-shaped hole. We have this hole that we're looking to feed with whatever our drug of choice is. And you can try to place pretty much anything into that. And I did that with drugs and alcohol for a long time. But what I realized slowly is that I had been doing stuff like that with people long before I ever picked up a drug or an alcohol. I was looking for people to make me feel like I was okay, make me feel like I was valid as a human, that I was attractive, funny, charming, interesting, you know, any of the things that you would want to feel about yourself, you know. But beyond that, I mean, those are all sort of almost second level adjectives. I would say the primary one is the word good, like having to do with shame or not having shame, like good and bad, you know what I mean? I wanted to feel good, you know, like I was good.
Be good enough.
Be good enough, you know, and I think that I didn't feel that way. And I've really struggled to feel, I think a lot of people do, you know, a lot of people live with that and we learn to live with that. And sometimes we don't even know we're coping with that. You know what I mean? Yeah. With
plenty of people that don't have substance abuse addiction issues, at least, but, absolutely, you know, that maybe struggle with some type of obsessive or compulsive behavior or thinking. This isn't really, in a way, an epidemic. The I'm not good enough in a lot of the shame-based belief systems that drive people into different levels of despair. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I find talking about, like, love addiction or simply just to, like, unpack that and just say, you know, the using of people to make yourself feel better, as interesting as recovery from drugs and alcohol, because it is something that people who aren't addicts suffer from. I mean, I have plenty of friends who I don't consider addicts, but really have some of the telltale signs of, and again, I don't consider them love addicts, but I'm like, oh, but this is what a love addict would do here. You know, you're using this person to lift yourself up,
right?
You know? Yeah. And I mean, we do this in the inverse as well, where we will gossip or talk poorly about other people in an attempt to make ourselves feel better. You know what I mean? So it's like, you're either using someone and their affections or their attention to make you feel like, oh, well, this person's good, and so by proxy, I must be good. Or you're like trying to find someone to sort of tear down, you know? So all of these are just the methods and means we go through to sort of try and feel like we're good.
Negative scorekeeping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that at the end of the day, like, the hope is that you just are comfortable with who you are and you are right-sized and, you know, you don't take yourself so seriously. That's my long-term goal, you know, is to feel good, but also just to feel like it's not even, I hope to some one day just say it's not about good or bad. I just am, you know, and I don't need to even label it like that. You know, that shame is, there's something almost dramatic about shame, and that you put so much energy into just like, oh, well, I'm just so worthless. I'm so bad. Yeah. I am so all of these things. And in doing so, I mean, just so much energy, you know, for anyone who lives with shame, you just know the amount of energy that you spend, you know, with those thoughts, with those feelings. You know, the thoughts that just come into your head and won't leave. And if you've ever woken up and the first thought is a negative one, if you've ever gone to bed at night and your last thought is a negative one, you know, right. You know what that feels like, you know? And so you will go to these drastic measures to escape that, whether it's for a day or for a minute. You know, towards the end of my drinking, I could get 20 minutes of not feeling shame out of it. And I would be hungover for a day and a half for that 20 minutes. I mean, I know that sounds extreme, but that's how it was for me. You know, is I just wanted that 20 minutes of just feeling like, you know, I think I'm kind of all right. You
know? And that was the first 20 minutes is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Okay. I mean, right when I'd gotten the perfect amount of alcohol in my system, and and then it was just kind of a mess after that, and the amount of alcohol I needed to get to that. But the reason I'm tying that back in is I'm saying, like, yes, I used drugs and alcohol for that, but it was solving for this problem that I think I'd had my whole life.
Yeah. You
know? And so now my recovery looks much more like, you know, how do I just, create a secure base?
Sure.
You know?
Well, and that's under the notion, too. This is what I'm hearing in the way you're explaining that, is the idea that the drugs and the alcohol are just a symptom of another underlying problem.
Right. I had before I ever even knew, like,
that existed ever before a substance was even introduced into the picture.
Exactly.
Which is pretty powerful, especially going back to the relational dynamics that we talked about with, you know, avoidant attachment definitely fits into that.
Right.
And not that there aren't plenty of people that have actually secure attachment that do struggle with substance abuse and addiction as well. So lots, and also, you know, relationships with food. You mentioned that as well, the dynamics of you're working on the two primary things being the relationships and then it's a relationship with food, too, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, coincidentally, I'm just, you know, this time last week, I was, you know, packing my bags to, I was already driving out to a mindful eating retreat near Longview, Washington, Washington State. I live in Portland, and so it's about an hour away from my apartment. And so I'm treating my process addictions, both with recovery, but also sort of with, like, I'm just attacking it from multiple angles, you know. Uh-huh. There is a lack of mindfulness and a lack of patience and in people who use people or food or television or whatever addictively. I mean, it is not a mindful exercise. If you've ever eaten a breakfast burrito in under 2 minutes, you know what I mean, or a Chipotle burrito in under three, you know that is not a mindful experience. You're not savoring the flavors of the bell peppers, yes, in your Chipotle burrito,
and not chewing every bite a blissful experience.
It is like you could put like a video of us next to a pack of wolves, you know what I mean, and it would like look like pretty much the same thing. Yeah, and I've been that person, and that was one of the things that was difficult about the retreat, is just realizing that my relationship to food is much more about emotional regulation than it is about nutrition or my body or anything like that. I mean, so much of it is, I mean, and so that's why this is something that I work on, is that I hope to one day probably not drink or use again, but I would like to have healthy relationships with things that are pleasurable.
So I was just going to ask that. So how does, you know, this is, I mean, I think the same thing applies with love and sex, or sex and love addictions, you know, because, you don't stop loving people, and you don't stop, right, probably having, you know, physical intimacy with people. Right. How does a foodie, you know, deal with food and emotional consumption addiction?
I mean, so like awareness is step one.
This is asking for a friend.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the awareness piece can take you like half a lifetime, you know what I mean? I hope I remember this correctly, because the woman who ran the retreat said something that was so profound and so simple simultaneously. She said, because this was at a Zen monastery, by the way, and she talked a lot about meditation and how it relates to mindfulness. And she said, meditation brings awareness. Awareness brings choice, and choice brings freedom.
Will you repeat that one more time?
She said, meditation brings awareness. Awareness brings choice. And choice brings freedom.
Perfect. Yeah.
So my answer to your question would probably be that process that I just described. Mm-hmm. Is at some point, if you feel like you have a poor relationship with something, you need to, like, whether or not it's like a conventional meditation practice, you need to just like check it out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you need to become aware, maybe not 100%, but just get some idea of the circumference of the problem, you know, whether it's approximate or not.
Yeah.
And then once you have, you know, that awareness, then you can choose to do something about it or not do something. They're both a choice. Choosing nothing is a choice, you know, and not beat yourself up along the way, by the way, because that's what I would do. I'm such a piece of, you know what?
The hammer comes out.
Right. And then, you know, making that choice, that's what brings the freedom. And that's, I think, really freedom. I thought that was kind of a weird word when she first said it, but then I really realized that's what I'm looking for with all of this, is like, because, and here's why I say that. I feel so completely free in someone who doesn't drink or take drugs. I cannot describe the freedom that I feel having never to like take one of those again if I don't want to. And that it does. Freedom is the perfect word for that. I was not free for 15 or 20 years, and I feel completely free now. And so am I still sort of like confined by those other things? I don't even know if they're addictions. They're just things that I struggle with. Yeah, I am. And so I would love to have freedom from those things. And so your original question was, what do you do about it? I think you do what I'm doing, which is that you just try something. Like, what is going to work for me is not going to work for the person listening to this, you know what I mean? Or their friend or their mom or you even, you know what I mean? What's going to work for everyone is totally different. I think if I was going to give advice, it would be Google something. That's what I did to go on this mindfulness retreat. Uh-huh. Like, I knew I had a problem with food. I've been to OA meetings. They don't really resonate for me. My therapist gave me some advice to do some research into a mindful eating process. Uh-huh. It took me 9 months to Google that. I'm not joking. It took me
from the time she suggested that
to when I got onto Google. Now, that Google search took me maybe 3.5 seconds to do, you know what I mean? But that was the 9 month and 3.5 second process that I took.
That's a great story in itself. Yeah. It took me 9 months and 3 seconds to find this.
Exactly. But I know you identify. That's why you're laughing, right?
I know. I totally
understand.
It's so
human,
it.
Right? Yeah. Just like it took me, 6 months and 4 hours to do my fourth step in AA, if you've ever done a fourth step. It's very, there's a great corollary to that. So that's what I would say, is I would say, what do? You just like... Don't have contempt prior to investigation. Don't try to recognize limiting beliefs. You know, if you're telling yourself, well, it's not that big of a deal because blank, or I can't be fixed because of blank, or I think those are the other things. This could get unpacked, you know, ad infinitum, you know what I mean? Like all of the things that can slow you down. But I think just being curious and being willing to like research how you can get better. It's amazing how many people have, you know, struggles with things in their life, and you ask them, well, like, what are you doing about this? Mm-hmm. And they're just like, well, what could I do? And I'm like, you're a creative person with great critical reasoning skills. Have you even Google searched something? Well, no. And I'm like, okay, well, so you just like suffer with this, right? And that was me for this. Isn't that coming from like a high horse? I mean, this has been me my whole life. So my advice would just be like, go try like a few different things and try and find something that works for you.
Perfect. I love that. That's a great explanation. Because that's really the truth about it, right? I mean, even with programs like AA or Smart Recovery, and you know, I've talked a little bit about more varying modalities, but you've got to find your own way, and even sometimes your own group within the fellowship, so that you know, there's a common language and a common way of thinking, and not to become isolated within that group necessarily, but you know. It's just like this notion of you know, learning different languages. It's you find a group of people that speak the same way you do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you keep trying until you do. Okay. You know, because what is going to work for one person, like AA is not going to work for some people. Smart's not going to work for some people. But if you keep trying, if you keep like turning the Rubik's cube, you'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out.
You know. Yeah. Okay. I think that's what people don't do. You know, is they. You know, they go look at one apartment. It's not for them, and so they just like stay in their crappy house. You know,
okay. we're gonna need to take a break.
Okay,
and we're back
after a brief interregnum.
Interregnum of about, I don't know, 3 hours
and a quarter pound of cheese ingested by me.
Oh, we were gonna talk about cheese.
Yeah, a very popular.
Very popular topic. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I have a lot of strong feelings about it. A lot of positive feelings about cheese.
A lot of positive feelings about cheese. You know, and like languages, there's many different varieties.
There you go. Oh, we're bringing it back. There are many varieties. And like languages, you got to find the one that works for you.
That works for you,
you
got to
find the cheese that really...
Yeah. Goat cheese is probably the safest, you know, on humans.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of feta cheese. I eat a lot of feta in my diet.
Yeah. Okay. And we apply this to our personal growth and life choices. We were talking, though, actually, about, before we got diverted off this, we were talking about diet and nutrition and issues associated with food and problems that often get associated with that. Because we were talking about the underlying core problems that often fuel and stem the shame and the fear associated with addiction. And how, you know, it starts, addiction started a long time ago in the sense of, if you're just identifying the problems, the symptom addiction started way earlier in life. And we really unpacked that, I think, in a fairly, I don't know what I'm trying to fucking say.
Hey, I have a question for you. If there's a precedent for the interviewer getting interviewed.
Yeah, you can interview.
Okay, so here's my... I want to know what your hot take is on this question. So you have now worked in recovery for over a decade. Is that right?
Almost two.
Yeah.
Actually, two. Yeah, I started my practicum in 99.
So here's my question for you. If you were to try to isolate a pattern of what will lead to someone's success or failure, whether or not you think someone's going to be able to kind of get it, you know, have you been able to discern any kind of pattern that you can kind of flag when you first meet someone? Or is everyone just different? You don't know, you have no idea. Or are there just things you've learned where... Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do. There are some traits. If... that I notice with people usually early on. Mm-hmm. And the first one is sort of a level of openness that demonstrates someone being teachable. Mm. And that's kind of a foundational component. Am I open and am I teachable? The second one is understanding the victim narrative or the victim voice. Mm. Having a natural grasp of what that means. From the aspect that I cannot, or I have spent a long time blaming who I am and what I do and what I feel on someone else. Mm-hmm. And they seem to have a natural affinity for realizing that my well-being is going to require that I'm accountable. And accountable for those things. And that's what I notice. There's sort of a humbleness that goes along with that in the beginning. But I have to be honest, Johnny, there are people that I have said, you know, I give them, you know, a 5% chance of making it, and they surprise me too. So, you know, I've met a number of people with very criminal thinking that have surprised me in ways that just kind of give me a level of hope that, you know, that there is something core within all human beings, that there is this desire to, you know, find and discover how to live a wholehearted life. I just become more and more surprised by that. And then there are people that I think that are brilliant and intelligent that do just the opposite, that I have a lot of faith that they're going to make it, and then they don't, so.
Hmm. And does knowing that affect the way that you treat people when they sort of express either of those two? Or if someone isn't very humble or doesn't seem teachable, or do you try to kind of nip that in the bud from the very beginning, or do you kind of treat everyone the same?
No, it really depends on the individual. You can't treat everyone the same. There have to be some consistencies. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, the majority of time is spent in group therapy, in treatment, at least in the agencies that I have worked in. That is the primary focus. And so there have to be a lot of consistency in that with how you treat everyone. They do need to be treated somewhat the same. But you do use different tools with different people. There's no doubt that having a number of modalities, and I'm talking about therapeutic modalities, you know, at one's toolbox, really allows to treat, you know, individuals in a way that, you know, you can't get in certain situations. Mm-hmm. It's not one size fits all. That's for sure. And there's a lot of pessimism in my field from that's gone on for a long time, right, that often overshadows, you know, the expectation of what people struggling with addiction are able to do and not able to do. So,
yeah, the stigma is certainly lessening.
Yeah,
but it's still there, and it is interesting how there are people who. Well, I guess that's society at large still feels comfortable just ignoring a certain part of the population, throwing certain groups of people away, you know, almost this subconscious, we'd be better off without this kind of person, or this kind of like moral blaming of people who are addicts that still exists.
Oh, it's huge. And that's, of course, where shame, you know, the one of the roots of shame is ostracizing the scarlet letter, so to speak, that has gone along with this, and the same with mental illness. Right. For a long time, this is May is Mental Awareness Month, and there definitely is a push, and there has been for a long time, especially with having the parity between physiological and, you know, medical illness and psychological and behavioral and mental health. There have been some deep changes, but there's still a lot of stigma associated with it. One of the things that's been going on here locally is the understanding that kids are often grow up in households where the stigma of getting treated for mental health prevents them from, you know, the family asking for help. And so often there's signs that are there, whether it be anxiety or depression, that don't get treated. And by the time it does come around, there can be all different other behaviors associated with it, whether it becomes oppositional defiant, or which often gets misdiagnosed as anxiety. I mean, anxiety often gets misdiagnosed as oppositional defiant, right. And depression the same way. And a lot of it doesn't ever get diagnosed, but it mostly there is a higher need for treatment and for services, and it's not being made available. So the outcome of that is it often leads to this problem where we talk about the, you know, deaths of despair, right. Which is growing, you know, exponentially among adolescents and also adults too. But adolescents is the numbers are sad and a bit frightening at times.
Yeah, it makes me think a lot about the kind of opiate epidemic. And I've got one more question for you if you're willing to. That first one was my softball question. This is going to be my more difficult question. Okay. So I hope you're ready. What, based on your experience, if you could change one thing, maybe not about the world, but just about the United States, you could just pull one lever and some issue that we have would change that you think would ameliorate our current addiction problem, whether it be, you know, spiritual, emotional, family related, school related. I mean, and I realize that this is, there are dozens and dozens of factors that lead to addiction. Yeah. But if you were granted one wish to cure addiction and you could change one thing, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? What do you think that would be?
It would probably be that one of the things I was just talking about would be about making or having services available for kids, mm-hmm. especially it saddens me to say this, but starting in elementary school and middle school especially, that if they had the ability to be able to choose to go and speak with a counselor if they wanted to. There is a research program going on right now here in Utah. It's been funded in a couple schools, and it's allowing students to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And when it was launched, there was such an immediate impact that they doubled or tripled the amount of therapists they were making available. Mm. And what is amazing about that, I believe, is that it's an intervention that is needed, and it's an intervention that's wanted by kids. By children and adolescents, they have someone to talk to that for whatever reason, they don't feel that they can do that within their family systems or within their support groups or even, you know, with their theological institutions. They don't feel that it's okay. One of the things that I've noticed, and I know I'm waxing a bit here, but it's this notion that and this is an issue that, I mean, 25% of my clients deal with this, either some type of LGBTQ issue. Mm-hmm. And it's the stigma associated with that is as disruptive as, you know, anything else we're talking about, whether it be mental health or addiction. And they don't have a lot of places to go to be able to talk about this because of that stigma. And the being able to ask for a therapist or a counselor to talk to process the worries and the shame and the guilt that may be going on in a family environment, which there's not a lot of understanding for this, I think is creates hope. And so to come back around and answer the question, I would start with making social counseling services available to kids in grade school as well as middle school, and, you know, up through high school, and make those services free to them.
It's interesting you say that. First of all, I hadn't heard of that research study, and that sounds fascinating. And the idea of normalizing the asking for help, you know, seems like the cure for a lot of things.
That it's okay to ask for help. And that has, that's part of the, that, that's been coming up. You notice that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, yeah. but that, that it's, there's a lot of push, and I see it coming through the media too. I mean, it's okay to ask for help. Right. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
I see it all over social media. If there's something going on, ask for help.
Right.
And so if it's done anonymously and it's offered there, I know some parents don't like this,
right.
but if your kids don't feel they can talk to you and they've got an opportunity to talk to somebody,
right.
my gosh, it probably will save lives.
Well, and interestingly, as you know, I had a personal experience with this in sixth grade when I saw Carrie Houston, and someone, my counselor that I'm embarrassingly naming by name. Hopefully you can bleep that out. But I saw a counselor at my junior high mm-hmm. that I went to, and I found that to be really powerful, and mm-hmm. that probably normalized and set the stage for me feeling less of a stigma to do that in my, you know, young adult life. Mm-hmm. I've seen a variety of therapists in my life, and a lot of that is just trying different modalities and kind of seeing, like I was saying earlier, trying different things and seeing what fits for you, mm-hmm. you know. And I would say that seeing this attachment therapist now, you know, this is the longest I've ever seen one person, but all of that was made very normal for me and less difficult by the fact that that was offered to me at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, they seemed like I had some problems, and that was a resource that school had available, and really appreciated that a lot.
Yeah, and that was not a norm.
Yeah,
when you look back at that time, that was a little bit ahead of the game and the curve.
Right,
and so I'm grateful, you know, that, you know, I had kind of forgotten about that, but I'm glad you mentioned it, and I see that as vitally important in today's world. I don't know if it's, you know, if it's the one thing, but I know that being able to allow support and services at that age and at that time, mm-hmm. it's something that's seriously missing. And the numbers of kids that are untreated right now is so high. And, you know, the stigma is that, you know, if they have a physical illness, you know, we'll take them to the doctor, but we don't want to talk about the mental illness issues or, you know, the maybe sexual orientation or gender identity issues. A lot of people just are uncomfortable with it and don't want to talk about it. And substance abuse and those other issues are those populations and those communities have a much higher rate of substance abuse than the general population. Right. So it does need to be dealt with and I think addressed. And the younger, the better.
So. That's a really great answer. I honestly, I hadn't thought about that as an answer to that. Yeah. But
what would be yours?
I hoped you wouldn't ask, because I realized as I was asking it, you know, I believe that the issues that I see are around self-esteem, community, tribe, and... Yeah, I'd be interested in thinking of ways where that sense of community and that sense of worth can be more easily given to children. I think that you aren't necessarily going to be guaranteed to engage in activities that make you feel good about yourself being put through like public elementary, middle school, and high school. We don't have any kind of national service here in this country where they do in a lot of other countries, mm-hmm. where whether it's military or otherwise, you're required to do a year of service, mm-hmm. which teaches you a lot about humility and service and pride and all of these things. I don't know what those initiatives would be, but that is a leak that I see is, I mean, in my friends who have been depressed or struggle with depression and myself, I just have felt at times like my life was kind of pointless in a lot of ways, you know, and I knew that I had talents and skills and I had wants and needs. It was a combination of things. It was that I didn't feel like I was fully expressing myself in a lot of ways, that I had a lot of things that I needed to express that I wasn't able to express. I didn't feel like I was getting the connection that I needed. I wouldn't have been able to label it that way at the time to say, oh, I'm not getting connection. Mm-hmm. But I think I clearly needed that and wasn't getting it. It probably just showed up as what they call teenage angst. You know what I mean? I mean, and which a lot of that is probably normal, but it'd be interesting to unpack like what teenage angst even is. Like there must be some teenagers that go through a very pleasant period.
Sure. You know, there may be, but that's what I was saying earlier is that there's this misdiagnosis and I've done it too. Misdiagnosing at times what I thought was oppositional defiance, and really it was someone who was dealing with anxiety. Right. And you know, that's kind of a wake-up call when you start looking at certain situations and certain behaviors, and not seeing that as not seeing the behavior and the reactions that the individual has as a symptom of something much different. And this was early in my career, and it was one of those aha moments where I went, I have had an attitude about this, I think, for a long time, and it's not a very healthy way to go about it, because it ends up again putting stigmatizing, you know, adolescence or in a way where they're looked at as it's a behavioral problem always. And the truth of the matter is, it's not. It's quite often a mental health issue, right, that needs to be addressed. And the behaviors are there because there's untreated anxiety or depressive disorder, right. And that is common. That is common. Okay.
So I guess if I were to totally shoot from the hip, I would say, I would implement required service. You know, and I don't. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't mean that as something draconian. I mean that is something
service draconian, though.
Yeah, interesting. like I don't mean it to be difficult but what I do think is that we get very obsessed with this idea of freedom in our country. Like freedom is this like really important ideal to us, and the freedom to just be able to just like do nothing with our lives, and the freedom to be able to just like isolate ourselves, and the freedom to be able to say whatever we want, and that comes with it a lot of good and really bad things. But I think we're always really careful in what we impose on other people. But I honestly believe, and this could be totally wrong, but I think if I were building a society, I would really think about the ways in which the young people in that society were required to do service for themselves. Not, I mean, it's great for the society because like work is getting done, but it's also great for them to feel like they're a part of something and they're doing something good. It teaches them humility, because there's a difference between like hating going to middle school every day. You know what I mean? Like we do require kids to go to school, but they don't really have to do much. And I don't think a lot of children are deriving self-esteem or meaning or a huge sense of purpose from school. That's just not the impression that I get. You know what I mean? I think they think of it more like a chore. And I would try to implement some kind of idea, whether it's at the, I don't even know what age necessarily, maybe it's post high school, like a lot of other countries do, where people are sort of required to do something for their community, you know? Does that sound totally crazy?
No, I think I totally actually agree with you. I think that should be part of it. I mean, that's one of the, we do community service every week at the treatment center, and it's one of the things that you get that people go, you know, I really thought that my life was in a certain way, but you know, I spent, you know, 3 hours today delivering meals to families that didn't have any food in their house, right. And I saw these kids, and I'm bringing in food, and the gratitude that on their faces, you know, some of them crying to see that someone's bringing food into their house, and I thought my problems were huge and insurmountable, and this was a wake-up call for me. So, no, I agree.
Yeah, to me, it accomplishes three things, three really important things. One, on its most basic level, it's just like work getting done. It's like it's productive in mm-hmm. many ways, you know. Two, it shows you, it makes you feel useful. It makes you feel like you have a purpose and that you have value and that you're needed. Mm. And then the third thing is that it equalizes you. This is the connection piece of it. It can equalize you with your peers. I used to volunteer at a residential house for people with HIV living under the poverty line in Portland. And what I appreciated about it is not only did it provide those other two things, not only was like work getting done, I just cleaned the kitchen and cooked dinner and that kind of stuff. B, it made me feel good about myself. It built self-esteem to be there. But C, interacting with the residents, these are people that I would normally never... So we walk around, we see each other, and sometimes we just see people and we say to ourselves, I have nothing in common with that person. You know what I mean? That, again, is this sort of like... problem with like metropolitan areas and big societies is we have the freedom to just like completely not associate with people if we don't want to, you know. But when you're put in these situations, and AA is a great equalizer as well, you know what I mean? Because I have become friends with people or been a sponsor or sponsee with people who I just never would have associated with. People have spent a lot of time in prison for violent crimes. I mean, just what does it say in the book? We are people who would normally not mix, you know? Right. And that's the third thing that I think it would accomplish is it just... forces you to be in contact with people. I think that's a good thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you know? Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean. And that's probably also this, it's about realizing, I mean, this is really important to the work I do too. This idea that we really all have more in common than we have differences.
Exactly. That's what I was going for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That when you really get down to it, when you sit down with somebody, and just get to know them, and I mean, you know, I'll shout out to, Queer Eye episode we were watching. Was it the Tom or whatever his name was? I can't remember.
Tom, but sounds right.
Yeah, Tom. That idea that, you know, when people just find that commonality no matter what, I mean, even though they may be completely different backgrounds and completely different lifestyles and a completely different social history, you know, but they get together and they have a common thing that they're working on, and they find out how much in common they have.
Right.
And they became, you know, they become good friends and bonded.
Right. And what is that doing? You're ameliorating loneliness, which is a cause for addiction, and you're building self-esteem, which also, so the reason I guess my head and heart goes there is because these seem like the roots in the ground. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Is that a lot of like kids who are in junior high or whatever, just like on their phones. And I didn't have a cell phone back then, but I definitely just dragged my feet a lot and just thought I was kind of a piece of crap. And it's so interesting, like, too, as we zoom out on service, is like community service is like a punishment in America. You know what I mean? And not that it isn't other places as well, but it's framed in this really negative way. Mm-hmm. You know, you only give service, I'm doing air quotes, you can't see that, if you're in trouble, you know? Like, what if we flipped it around and it was something that was revered, you know? It was something that was cool. Yeah, I'm sure in certain circles it is, but wouldn't that be an amazing society where, like, the people who are out doing service were, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I would try to implement something like that. I think that is just as important as the education you're giving kids is the instilling in them all of these things that we're talking about, you know?
Well, and I think that this is one of those, this is a subject that is hard because the messaging of this, there's not much of it within our political systems at this point.
Right.
And so the messaging doesn't come out very well. And in fact, the messaging that comes out from, you know, political leaders and things like that quite often is the opposite of that.
Right.
It's, you know, what can you do for me kind of thing.
Yeah. And you can imagine if some Democrat came along and said that we were going to implement something like this, you know, the Republican marketing team would come along and say, you know, just like they did with death panels, they'd say, we're taking your Saturday away. The Democrats want to take your Saturday away,
right.
You know, as opposed to all of these positive things that we're kind of talking about.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Who knows? Maybe service will be labeled as socialism. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to move on.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me, we'll kind of go through a series of questions kind of here. So what brings you joy in life?
Oh, that's such a good question. That brings me joy. I like to think that I enjoy people and things that are funny. I try to have a sense of humor. And I am feeling joy when I'm laughing a lot of the time. So I have a few friends in Portland, and many of them have very good senses of humor. And, you know, what came into my mind when you asked that question was just a few people with whom, when we're together and I'm laughing, I'm achieving a kind of childish joy that, you know, can only be achieved when laughing with friends and yeah. sort of kind of rolling around on the ground, kind of laughing kind of stuff. That might be the most intense kind of joy that I can feel, is being with someone that I really like or care about and just really getting to laugh with them,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And we all have a friend. We can all think of someone with whom, like,
sure.
you just laugh and laugh and laugh with them. You know, recently, what brings me a lot of joy is my dog, you know, and,
Felina,
she's a little husky shepherd mix. And you know, the outdoors and nature, that will sound cliche or trite to people listening to this, but you didn't know that I, you know, up until I was about 25, just hated the outdoors, did not want to be outside. And, and I'm kind of going through this kind of rebirth period in myself where I find myself just, and this is going to sound so stupid, but I mean, I'm just walking along and I am just like the beauty of Portland or the beauty of Salt Lake since I've been here in the mountains, and it just takes my breath away. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I went on a walk right before we did this podcast earlier mm-hmm. and I just, and it could be just that I've just never felt that way before. Mm-hmm. But that brings me a lot of joy, just yeah. Kind of the beauty of the world. This sounds yeah. so ridiculous.
No, that's I think that's the same for a lot of people, is, you know, connecting in some way to nature, which is kind of my second question here is, or my next question is, how do you, you know, connect to that Zen spot within you? I talk about this sort of being the Zen zone, the podcast that, you know, welcome to the Zen zone. But every, you know, that, how do I do that? And a lot of people that come on say, you know, they, one of the ways that they connect to that Zen part of themselves is they get into nature. They feel actually connected to themselves at the same time. And maybe it's a state of, you know, finding peace or tranquility or serenity or something. How do you find serenity or connect with that Zen zone in, for you?
I have a meditation practice that comes and goes, but I'm doing a pretty good job of it lately. And I feel very, not that that's very controversial that you would feel Zen when you were meditating. that's become something that has really become a priority for me as, I'm trying to become, I suppose, a more just Zen person mm-hmm. with consistency in my life. And my daily meditation practice involves 10 minutes of silent meditation. It's rarely guided. It's typically an opportunity for me to do what I call building mental strength or equanimity. I imagine difficult situations. I imagine moments from my day or the past 24 hours where I have felt impatient or angry or victimized or any of these things. And I imagine myself dealing with it in a different way or I imagine myself not responding. I imagine what it would be like just to sit there and to not respond in that moment. I kind of replay the moment in my mind. So I kind of just made this up myself, but that's something that I...
Beautiful.
Yeah. It's like, well, I call it like mental toughness.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always help me the next time that similar situation comes along, but it's a really powerful practice for me, is to just rewind the tape and go back to that moment where I lost my temper, or where I wanted to, even just mentally wanted to lose my temper, and in my mind I was screaming expletives, and just to go back to that and imagine, you know, what would it be like to have this person have said that to me and to just had no problem. So I do that for 10 minutes and I kind of try to toughen up mentally, and then I pray, typically a rehearsed prayer, something from AA, and then I make a gratitude list, and my gratitude list is just the first three things that pop into my mind that I already have, that I'm happy that I have. You know, there's that, I heard that great line. I'm like, happiness is about not getting what you want, but wanting what you have. I think so. I heard that. It was like, need that on a pillow or something like that.
Yeah.
so the meditation definitely gets me into the Zen zone. And
I like that. I like that meditation. Yep. What's the pillow again? One more time. I want to visualize
Happiness is not getting what you want. It's wanting what you have.
Okay. Not that it's a pillow, but I can see it on a pillow too. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Or bumper sticker. Or, yeah. You
know. Oh, okay.
20 more of these little aphorisms. If you, if you've been in AA for 7 years, right, you've got, you got a lot of these.
Got a lot of them. Yeah. Okay. What's your thoughts about, God, the universe, higher power, what's the meaning to life, or,
It's such a softball you're throwing me here.
In a nutshell,
Gosh, I'm glad it wasn't a tough question. I'll try to answer those separately. My definition of God is just... it's common, I suppose, in recovery, in that it's sort of like all things. It's existence. It's whatever I'm a part of. And it includes me, but I am, one. There isn't a fraction small enough to really express how small of a piece of it that I am. But I just try, when I pray, I try to imagine the ways in which I'm connected to everything around me, whether it's the couch I'm sitting on or the plants on my desk or whatever. I do, when I can honestly feel connected, I feel very safe and very comfortable, and my fear of death goes away and all those, or is at least mitigated. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I don't believe in a monotheistic God. I don't believe in, divine creation or anything like that, but I do, while some people will say love, which is not exactly my spirituality, mm-hmm. but I find that very charming. I'm as someone who's, very, I'd like to say gentle. I find that to be a great answer. Like, I might roll my eyes when people say that, but there's a part of me that's kind of like, okay, that's cute. In terms of what the meaning of life is, do you know who the comedian Patton Oswalt is?
I do know Patton Oswalt.
He had a comedy special after he'd kind of healed from his wife dying. And I will always remember, I don't remember word for word what he said. But something about what his wife had used to say, she worked with people who were in difficult situations. And he basically had some quote with her, which was, life is really hard, be kind, or something like that, and I always thought that was really beautiful. But for myself, the way I define it, and sort of if I were to define the center of my moral compass, which is maybe what the meaning of life is for me, is it's really just to try to reduce suffering. Is my hope when I look back on my life is I can say that I suffered when I was a child. I caused other people to suffer for a long time after that. And then I kind of woke up at one point and I reduced suffering for the rest of my life. And I was an agent that had led a peaceful existence where I tried to do as little harm as possible. Mm-hmm. And where possible, I reduced suffering for other people or other creatures, mm-hmm. And I think that if everyone who was a sentient being or had consciousness was working towards that same goal, then it would be a totally different planet that we lived on. Like, I don't expect like the deer and the anteaters and the dolphins to make the world a better place. I think like humans need to, do their best to heal. The onus is on each of us to heal ourselves so we can stop doing harm to others. And right. You're never going to be perfect. You're always going to do some harm, even if unintentionally.
Yeah.
But I think to live a life, and this is, this totally sounds Buddhist as I say this.
I know. I was going to comment. I was going to say how Zen and Buddhist.
And I think Buddhism, you and I talked before this podcast, mm-hmm. but I think that Buddhism is something that my own beliefs, having never studied Buddhism, really overlap and dovetail with Buddhism quite a bit, and so I could probably see myself getting into that at some point. Yeah. But yeah, I believe that life is suffering, which they say, and that reducing harm is a good idea. So that is my spirituality in a sense, and that's my morality for myself is to hopefully live a long, productive life where I reduce suffering and have some fun at the same time. and feel joy.
And feel joy and laugh.
I think I'm entitled to some joy mixed with doing service and hopefully reducing suffering with others.
Yeah. I remember, you know, you were talking about that a minute ago about working in that that kitchen at that home.
Yeah.
That seemed like a really powerful experience, and the people you worked with, that was felt like such a community of people. I remember.
Yeah, I still stay in touch with a lot of them.
Yeah. That's sometimes what I think simply life is about, if there's a meaning to it. And maybe that just encompasses the things you just talked about. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate you asking that question.
Yeah. Okay. I think what we'll do is I'll just ask that the last question I said I was going to ask about music.
Yeah.
So if there were a couple songs that represented your, in some way, your life journey, or had some have some special meaning to you, or if there was a life celebration for you, what couple songs would you have? And I don't know if you know this, but I've been working on a playlist for my life, and we've joked about it with you guys for the kids for years, but I actually have been working on it, so. It's pretty eclectic at this point.
Can I ask what one of your favorites from that is?
There's a lot of them, but it starts off with "Got to Be Real" by I want to say Cheryl Ladder, but whatever. It's a funky kind of a disco song that has always been a favorite of mine. That's about, to me, you know, breaking, this is what it's meant to me, okay? It's about breaking through cognitive dissonance is what it's meant to me. So, yeah, about getting real with oneself of how they view, you know, how they show up in people's lives, about being real.
Right.
It's got to be real. But it's a popular dance song.
It sounds very familiar to me.
Yeah.
My guess is if I had, here's what I think is going to happen. I think I'm going to answer now. And then when I'm on the plane tomorrow, flying back to Portland, I'm going to be so mad that I didn't give a better answer or something that it's more, because I bet there is just some really great song that I'm just blanking on right now. But the one that really comes to mind for me is a song by a band called Aukerville River, which is called Lost Coastlines. It is a song that is very autobiographical about the band itself. It's very meta, and it kind of
I know the song.
Oh, do you know the song? It's incredibly well written and very beautiful and very catchy and has a really nice kind of swing beat, drums behind it, and a really great bass line. And it's just paints a really beautiful story of their trials and tribulations as a band. And one thing that I really love about it is filled with so much hope and so much sadness at the same time. And I guess I always felt like it was a really vulnerable song to release, where it felt like a journal entry from the band. And so while it doesn't necessarily, I'm sure there's an answer to this where if I were 14, I'd say Glycerine by Bush or something like that. Or from 16 Stone was the song that was most meaningful to me. Or if I was, 22, I'd be talking about a Bright Eyes song. But
no Nirvana?
No, you'd think so, right? I mean, that wasn't my kind of angst.
No, I got it.
My anger was internal, not external, so even though I enjoyed grunge music, I didn't necessarily resonate with the language. So that's a song that I've really, really thought a lot about, and it's helped me. I don't know. I don't know why that stands out for me, but I found it very vulnerable and interesting. And it was a really big hit for that band, too.
It was.
Yeah.
And it felt really vulnerable, too.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why I liked it so much. And I remember you had actually talked to me about the band, I think, before that song came out. I think that was on the album, their first album.
No, this was on their fourth or fifth album.
Yeah, it was later on. But I remember you had talked to me, Ben. I started listening to them, Yeah, and by the way, Johnny turned me on to a lot of music that I was not exposed to. All my kids have. And I was funny because I just put on Phoenix upstairs. Mm-hmm. We were listening to it, and I was putting it on, and I was going thinking, you introduced me to Phoenix.
I love that band. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And this was years ago, guys. Okay. So anyway, anything else you want to add in there?
The song that this is going to be recency bias, but I will say that the song, I want to say it's called Daydreaming by Radiohead off their new album. It's the second song on their new album. I literally cried when I saw Radiohead for the first time and they opened with that song, and I'm not like a big crier in public. And then when I saw the music video for the first time, I wept. The song, or a lot of the album, I believe, is about his partner who passed away, and I think a lot of the songs are about that. And in the music video, it's just a series of him going through doors searching for someone. And you'll have to listen to it. It's the slowest, saddest song on the entire album, and nothing has grabbed me recently as powerfully as that song has grabbed me. And when you get the context, when you start to kind of put the picture, and I don't know that that's what this song is about, but as I'm ascribing meaning to it for myself,
right.
And that's what we do with songs.
What we do with songs.
So if you haven't heard that song, I definitely recommend giving it a listen. It is incredibly beautiful. And Tom York is just incredibly talented. But
amazing.
Really great song.
He's amazing. He's amazing. Yeah. Thank you, Johnny. This was really wonderful.
This has been a real treat.
I really appreciate you being willing to sit down and share. I have no idea, an hour and a half, 2 hours with me today. and here in our family room.
Yeah, we're downstairs in the basement.
At the, the Randack Hacienda here in Sandy, Utah. I love you. I'm grateful for you. I have learned a lot from you, and I hope that that can continue for a long time.
I really want to thank you for having me on. And all I can think is I can't wait to do this again. So I hope this is the first of many.
I hope so, too. Yeah. All right. And we will go out, as we always do, with a little Joan Osborne. See you guys soon.
Just